Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you again, Audrey, and indeed, you are our spiritual and technical advisor for our radio show. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I must apologize for being absent for a couple weeks or more. I scheduled the show, changed the show date on and off based on issues and health and, oh my gosh, all kinds of things, shopping in other towns. Hey, don't want to get me started, Audrey, on my new Rambler all-terrain tarot track that is coming. Okay, but anyway, welcome to our show, and we hope you enjoy it. Tonight we have a very interesting guest, and her name is Kimberly Malem Orozco, and she's a professor at George Mason University, and covering a topic that doesn't get very much in-depth topic coverage. I mean, we hear about human trafficking, and okay, people do this, they do that, but this woman has indeed studied it, so I think you'll show. And what we'll also do is picking up, a lot of our news tonight has to do with the gun issue, and you know what's going on with that, with the president, the Congress, state legislatures, law enforcement officials, all based on that terrible shooting in Florida at Parkland High School. And we have a lot of news about that and some facts to bring you that I've not heard a number of these commentators, many of these commentators, say a word about them. And we'll get comments from people like Ann Coulter and saying, by the way, if you've never read any of Ann Coulter's work, she is a scholar. If you read her book on immigration, Adios America, we're talking 300 plus, footnotes. I mean, that type of thing. But she is a scholar. Yes, she is a conservative. And we respect that as well. We respect others with a different point of view. So anyway, that's what's on for tonight. And Johnny Cash did get us through that before. And what we try to do with this show, we've done for over 400 shows, who's counting? We want to discuss news, issues, and events, and developments that are always difficult and sometimes humorous practice, or part of the practice of criminal justice. We dedicate this show to our tireless law enforcement, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States. And we don't hear enough about that. We hear about mistakes they've made, probably in Florida, but we don't hear about the lives they save in fires and collapsed buildings and car wrecks and on and on and on. So what we try to do is look inside criminal justice and get some more information about what they do. If you're doing this on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and that means what? That means that you could have your own show. Any person, interest group, can have their own show, and they can broadcast in streaming audio worldwide. And guess how much it costs? Nothing. Unless you're down in the prime time hours, like 4 to 8 or 9 or something like that, maybe even 10, you can broadcast absolutely free. Can you believe that? It's still, when I did this 400 plus shows ago, I couldn't believe it, and I still can't believe it. It's absolutely incredible. And people have become very successful. If you look on the site, you see those people that use the social media and the special advertising, which I don't do, but it's really some good show. They have shows and everything. Want a show on baseball? That's coming up. We got a number of those to look at. But anyway, it's a great thing, and you ought to try your own show. You can try it for a week or two, three. If you don't like it, stop. You don't have to do it. You don't have to do it at all. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get to some of the news here tonight. Give me time to raise this up. On Evernote, and we'll talk about some of this new stuff. And this is an odd one. I'm sorry to start with this one, but guess what? The New York City Police Department is battling with the issue of fat police officers. They call it, this article is overweight cops, and the brass isn't doing one thing about it. And this problem is ballooning. Yeah, we really are the largest police department, the world's largest, said one veteran cop in Manhattan, Brooklyn. We're the fattest police department in the country because we have no requirement to stay in shape. Can you believe that? I was a police officer back in the Ice Age, and we had requirements to stay in shape. You were taken off the road if you didn't do that. Here's an example of one guy. Now, he is getting some medical treatment now, but this cop, he weighs, well, 17 years ago, he weighed 180 pounds. Today, this New York City police officer, Jose Vega, weighs 395 pounds. So he went from 180 to 395 during his 17-year career. And the sources blame this on the lack of any fitness mandate. I'm not going to go into this blood test and cardio exams or weigh-ins and all that. There are all kinds of programs that can meet this need and keep these officers in shape. But I would have never believed that an officer could still be on the police department and weigh 395 pounds. And at one time, he weighed 190. Okay, let's take a look at this mass shooting by immigrants. This is the business by Ann Coulter. You don't hear much about this, but Ann understands immigration. She has studied it. We're hauling in nearly 2 million manifestly unvetted third world immigrants every year in the United States. Did you hear that? 2 million unvetted each year into the United States, leading to a slew of FBI watch lists that they can't even keep track of. Said there were ISIS investigations in all 50 states, even Idaho and Alaska. But look at what she breaks down now. It's a long article, but what she does, she says, I want to excuse myself for using the word immigrant to be used only in sentences with the word to be used only in sentences with the word valedictorian. You may not have heard some of these. She's funny if you listen to her. But here's a guy, Omar Mateen, son of African immigrants, killed 49 people at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. All right, remember that one? First and second generation Pakistani immigrants, Saeed Farooq and Tashin Malik, opened fire at a community center Christmas party in San Bernardino, California, killing 14 people. One English immigrant, Harper Mercer, killed 9 people at Umpqua Community College in Southwest Oregon. I'm not going to go through all these, but she has got in her list 16 cases for these people, and they're from various countries and South Korea, I mean, all over the place. And they're committing these crimes, and you don't hardly hear anything about this in this discussion. I mean, this terrible case of this Nicholas Cruz in Florida, I mean, he's a guy that should have been tagged numerous times. Well, they did tag him, but they didn't do anything about it. But anyway, it's interesting to know about that. We have an Ohio sheriff here who's a very popular guy, and his name is Richard Jones. By the way, he worked his way up through corrections to be sheriff. I don't think he was ever a law enforcement officer. Started as a correction officer, manager up through the prison system, that type of business. But he's offering free gun training to teachers in response to the Parkland, Florida school shooting of 17 people. We thought we'd get 20 to 25 people signed up. Can you believe that? He wants to train teachers. We had 50 within the first hour. We had 100 within 2 hours. And then he had 300 within 5 hours. Can you believe that? We offered teachers first. Then we started getting calls from a secretary that works in the school, janitors that work in the school, and on and on and on. So you've got all these school staffers that train the educators, or more schools are beginning to train their educators to do that. And, you know, there are people who have had armed police officers on their grounds for years. The school resource officer idea was born in East Lansing, Michigan, the assistance of Michigan State University, I believe, and its criminal justice department. And that's where I got my master's degree, one of the top three or four criminal justice programs in America. And then the other one was down in Cincinnati when I did their master's degree, and they have a doctorate, and but they're the top three: Michigan State, Cincinnati, John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and then once in a while Eastern Kentucky falls in that, the top criminal justice programs in America. And there are jobs all over the place in criminal justice. I hope you realize that. Go get a job. Here's a school district. Teachers could soon be carrying CCW, carrying concealed guns, in Pike County, Kentucky. And it was improved Monday by the Pike County School Board. A unanimous decision after the board heard concerns about school safety from teachers and parents and administrators. I want to mention something about Kentucky. Years ago, I probably mentioned this. My mother, who went to school in Kentucky a long, long time ago, for a number of years, she rode a horse to school. And when she got to school, she got off the horse, and they had a place to tie them up. And then she took her rifle out of the sack on the horse and walked into the school like other students, children who have not exactly children, but a little bit older. And then they laid their guns up against the wall, went to school all day, picked up their guns, got on their horses or however they got there, and went home. And guess what? No one ever shot anybody. But Pike County School Superintendent Reed Adkins said he hopes the board will give final approval within 2 to 3 weeks and have armed staff in our schools, if not sooner. You know, I was going to talk about the Academy Awards last night. I did hear one commentator say, look at all the armed security people during the Academy Awards ceremony. Yeah. And I think a lot of people in that group, here I am talking about it, a lot of people in that group probably wouldn't have been on the side of arming school people. Okay, let me see. What do we got here? Guns used to stop felons each there. I don't think I'll do that. Minnesota gun owners and low crime. There's a good one. Last year, from the number of gun background checks the FBI conducted in the state, more people are carrying guns than ever before, but the crime rate remains relatively low. I won't go into details. Minnesota's violent crime hit a 50-year low in 2016, and a lot of people are carrying firearms. And you've heard that definition of a liberal many, many, many times on this show. What's it say? It says... How do you define a liberal? Someone who hasn't been mugged yet. Is that right? Someone who hasn't been mugged yet. Okay. Okay. Penalties on, this is a nationwide study, but penalties for texting drivers. Have you met some? And the victims include a 23-year-old highway construction worker in Washington State, a 13-year-old Michigan boy riding his older sister's car, in his older sister's car, a Minnesota school bus driver, all dead because of what? Simple people texting in their cars. I see them every day. How about the ones you got to honk at a red light and make them go forward because they're sitting there reading or writing a message or talking one or something like that. But anyway, here's something. I used to live in Cincinnati for 15 years and taught at the University of Cincinnati and started a number of different kind of programs there. No one ends up on the highest death row by getting lucky. Ohio leads the state. Hamilton County has sent more people to death row, that's Cincinnati, and is responsible for more executions than any county in the state since capital punishment returned in 1981. The county has a large death row population per capita than the home counties of Los Angeles, Miami, or San Diego, and has more people on death row than all but 21 of the more than 3,000 counties in the United States. There are 24 convicted killers now on death row in Hamilton County. 10 others from the county have been executed since the death penalties returned. So anyway, it's interesting. There are 6, 8, 7, 8, 9 arguments, pro and con, about the death penalty. I won't go into that. But if you read Robert Boehm and Keith Haley's book on Introduction to Criminal Justice by McGraw-Hill, and particularly Bob Boehm's specialty book called Death Wish, I think that's it. Is that right? Yeah. Anyway, Boehm is an expert on the death penalty and a very fine professor. We've done that. Armed school teachers. I think I'm going to skip that one about giving social workers, giving them Miranda warnings, and because they find out information about crime and turn it over to the cops. And had they been interviewed by a cop, the cop would have had to give them Miranda warnings if they were going to use information against them. Okay, let's just finish up with this one. Here's a guy. He's the world's most persistent illegal immigrant. One Mexican man managed to get deported 44 times in 15 years. Now, keep in mind, these are the people we've caught. They aren't the ones that we catch going back and forth every 2 weeks to Mexico. But the runner-up was ousted 40 times between 2001 and 2015. Number 3, 4, and 5 on the list were deported 35, 34, and 31 times. And here we have people like the mayor of what is Oakland, California, who's trying to protect these people and warning them that ICE raids are going to be coming. That is Oakland, right, Audrey? Yeah, I think so. Not San Francisco. But can you believe that? I mean, and think of how many people are doing this. And there are people that kill drunk drivers in Indiana. He plowed into a pro football player, Edwin Jackson, and his Uber driver, killing them both. One Mexican managed to get deported 44 times in 15 years. That's the guy I just talked about. But he also managed to sneak back across the border at least that many times. So who knows how many times that's actually been. But just incredible. I mean, we can love all these people from wherever they come, whether they are illegal immigrants or not, but how many people can we take illegally, and how much can our welfare system support? You know these people are getting various government services, and thank you for paying your taxes. But anyway, it's just incredible that is actually going on. Okay, I think we'll do now is our usual green tip, and I'm going to replay this one. I won't play it. But you know about the Earl of Sandwich in 1762. He's the guy that invented sandwiches because he didn't want to leave his gambling table. This is in England, the Earl of Sandwich. That's an actual title in the area in England. And he started that, and the University of Westminster did a study just recently, and they found out that the most dangerous thing to the planet in terms of using carbon dioxide junk and killing our planet were sandwiches, because of all the different fruit and grain and all the stuff that has to go into it. So I am asking you, ask McDonald's and Burger King and Dairy Queen if they'll do it, stop serving and eating sandwiches. Okay. They're serious about it at Westminster. All right, how about a blonde joke for tonight? Keep in mind these are blonde men, not blonde women. Two blondes drove to the mall and lost the car keys. They ended up in the parking lot trying frantically to unlock their car door with a coat hanger. The first blonde said, "I can't seem to get this door unlocked." And the second blonde answered, "Well, you better hurry up and try harder, because it's starting to rain and the top is down." Okay, I like that one. All right, what we're going to do now is we're going to listen to Professor Kimberly Melman Orozco talk about human trafficking in the United States and what a serious issue this is, and certainly it's tied to illegal immigration also. I hope you realize that. So give me time to set this up. It won't take long, and we'll be listening to the professor very shortly.
Every sizable city in this country is home to some form of human trafficking,
being
and
introduced.
Every one of us at some point has purchased something that is the product of modern-day slavery. So we're all affected by it, and it behooves us to learn more about the roots of the issue and what action we, and more importantly our government, can take to address it. Please join me in welcoming Kimberly Orozco Melman.
First and foremost, I wanted to say thank you to Politics and Prose for hosting my first book talk and signing event after the publication of my first book. So thank you for the wonderful introduction. A little bit more about me, in addition to serving as an expert witness, being an author and a consultant on human trafficking issues, I'm also the mother of four children, two girls, two boys, and so it's very, very busy at my household. But I tell you that because I want to tell you how I became interested in looking into human trafficking. So I first heard about the topic while I was in graduate school. I was taking a course by Dr. Louise Shelley, who's one of the foremost experts on the issue. And she was telling me about how modern-day slavery existed, which was news to me. It was something very evocative, and it was troubling to me that this was going on, and I hadn't heard about it up until that point. So I started looking into the issue myself. I started, researching articles, conducting systematic reviews, conducting empirical research, and publishing in an ivory tower, as you do while you're in graduate school. But nothing could have prepared me for the moment in which I encountered the first person who I suspected of being a victim. And the reason being is it was on the front doorsteps of my home in Montclair, Virginia. I was cooking dinner. My husband was still at work, and we were getting ready to take my oldest daughter to track practice, and I heard a knock on the door. And it was a mid-dinner time interruption, and as you can imagine, with four children, I was, kind of perturbed and I didn't really want to answer it, but I went down, and it was a young lady selling an all-purpose cleaner. She said, "Hello, ma'am. I'm selling magic in a bottle. Few squirts and it'll erase any stain that you have. Can I talk to you about this item that I'm selling?" And most people, if you're like me, don't really like door-to-door salespeople, and usually they'll shut the door pretty quickly. But I had recently learned about human trafficking within door-to-door sales crews. So I heard her out and I started asking her questions. She was up here in Virginia from North Carolina. She was staying in a motel with 15 other kids that some were runaways, some were homeless, and they were all pooling their money together. All of their money was taken every day. They didn't eat if they didn't make money, and it was just a very red flag after red flag type of situation. And so that's when I started to look into it a little bit further. And the concept for my book came out of the reality that existed behind the headlines. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about human trafficking, but I guarantee that none of you have heard it from the mouth of a human trafficker, from the insight of a victim and understanding what happens behind those headlines. So the objective of the book was really threefold. I wanted to take readers, A, behind the headlines of what actually happens. Two, or B, I wanted to expose the various forms of human trafficking that existed in the United States and that we use and consume and interact with on a day-to-day basis. And then C, I wanted to confront failed solutions and understand how do we bridge this gap between law in the books and law in action. So take readers behind the headlines, objective number one. In order to do that, I actually did a survey. I started writing and interviewing convicted human traffickers. I wanted to get insight about their crime from their words, through their eyes. And one of the things that I found was they were actually quite nice. It didn't happen like a made-for-Hollywood TV movie. This wasn't, you know, Liam Neeson coming in and rescuing his innocent victim daughter from gun-wielding Albanian mobsters. It wasn't the movie Taken. These men were very nice. They were very articulate. They were very intelligent. They were very charismatic. And that's what they used to exploit and use women. So I want to read you a few quotes that are in the book because I think it sheds light into who these people are. So the first quote I read is from chapter 1, page 11. And this comes from a man who trafficked a 12-year-old girl from New York to D.C. He was the first person sentenced to life in prison for his crimes. He sex trafficked this woman across multiple states, or this child, rather. And when asking him, you know, why does this happen? Why did he engage in this type of crime? This is what he told me. Why does a prostitute need a pimp? To guide her, to love her, to protect her. The pimp is the father that she never had. He is that big brother that she misses, or the boyfriend from back in the day. The pimp is that husband that she fantasized about over and over. He is the popular guy in school. The neighbor paid her attention in class. To her, he is what Christ is to a Christian. The blood that pumps in her heart and keeps her legs moving. Without him, there is no her. You need to understand, a hoe was put on this earth to be pimped by her pimp. Not all pimps, players, or macs possess the same characteristics, but what we all have is a common, what we all have in common is a unique way of life and love for women and how they are able to use what they have to get them and us what they need. Notice I said need. We all need money to survive. Chilling. Disturbing.
Disgusting.
This convicted human trafficker also told me he never lets his left hand know what the right is doing. He would compartmentalize information in order to exploit and use each of the women and children who were being sex trafficked by him. And he wasn't alone. I interviewed trafficker after trafficker after trafficker, and they all had this common thread. They were all extremely charismatic, very intelligent. In chapter 8 of the book, I interview a convicted human trafficker who's from the Ukraine. He trafficked adult women from the Ukraine to a strip club in Detroit. And he spoke four languages. He could quote great philosophers from memory. He was very, very intelligent. He told me, a cunning individual is very capable of making another person believe that he or she is in control, concealing their intentions until they lead that person to the edge of a cliff. That's how a trafficker is able to recruit, control, and exploit their victims, concealing information. It's not kidnapping, and that's one of the reasons why it is so very difficult to prove in a court of law. Because these men will make these children and women believe that they're in love with them. They will promise them every dream that they could imagine. They will fulfill those dreams. The reality doesn't come out until months, years later. And by that time, sometimes it can be too late. They're too afraid to report it to law enforcement. They have done things that they think they will be judged or criminalized for, and that is what happens. This same trafficker, the one who trafficked girls from Ukraine to Detroit, I wanted to read another quote from him. This was in the early stages of our interviews. And I think it shows how he can interact on par with his conversant, right? He knew I was smart. He knew I had a doctorate. And he wanted to portray himself also as an intellectual person. He wrote, "At the end of the day, this experience makes me a better and stronger person. The things I took for granted before will be cherished now. It's like a rebirth. You get to experience life all over again." How many people can say that? People out there are tired of monotony. They go through life like a repetitive exercise, always complaining and never content, not realizing how fragile life is and how easily it could be turned upside down. You never truly respect and appreciate things, so you lose them. And I've lost almost everything, but I never lost the will and determination to persevere. I didn't buckle under this tremendous weight, but instead flourished as a person. Maybe I didn't flourish materialistically, but in the grand scheme of things, you can always obtain material wealth. The question is, can you ever obtain character? Character is forged under pressure. Pressure alone can make or break you. Poetic. I think that was beautifully put. It really resonated me, and I said, wow, this person's really smart. He's very articulate. He's very intelligent. The emotions that he expressed about being in prison was really affecting to me, and I said, you know, this is really surprising, but that's exactly what they do. They put on this facade. They put on a persona, and it isn't until months later that it comes out. So this was in the early stages. That's what he said, in the early stages of our interviews. Can you imagine what he said to me 6 months later? Do you think it changed? Oh, it did. He wrote, "If I were a dude and I can get my hands on you, I'd beat your beep bleep brains in and make you remember how to measure your bleep words. On the streets, it'd be either you get me or I get you. But since you're a dumb bleep, and I don't beef nor do I gossip with bleep, it's bleep you. Now go play in traffic." Sorry for all the bleeps, but there might be children. It's not bleeped out in the book. Shocking. It was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Look how he changed in the way he spoke in a matter of 6 months. That's what is experienced by these victims of human trafficking. They believe they're engaging in a consensual relationship in the beginning. They have no idea that they're being used and exploited until it's too late. So those are some of the quotes from traffickers. But for this book, I also interviewed and obtained quotes from consumers of the commercial sex trade, right? Men who purchase sex for sale. The demand aspect of the commercial sex industry. And when I first thought of this, I thought, oh, these guys are in back alleys. You know, these aren't anybody, this isn't somebody that I know. But the men that I interviewed, most of them had master's degrees and above. I interviewed a journalist, a PhD educated professor who started procuring commercial sex services after his wife contracted cancer. I interviewed an anti-AIDS nonprofit JD, an attorney. Men who purchase these services that fuel the demand take all shapes and sizes from different socioeconomic backgrounds, from different education backgrounds, races and ethnicities. It bridges all demographics. And so one of the chapters, in a later chapter, I talk about the mentality of these men. So you hear about them in the news as Johns, right? Johns, they pay for sex. That's not what they call themselves. They call themselves mongers or hobbyists. Monger as in W-H-O-R-E, monger. That's what they refer to themselves. And this one individual who went by the handle Dirk, I followed him over a period of time. He was a former member of the military, and he engaged in sex tourism across the world, procuring services. His wife had divorced him, and he thought he was living it up. He claimed to be making $160,000 a year salary, and that's how he chose to spend his money, purchasing women. And if one denied one of his requests, he would have another within 20 minutes that would acquiesce. But it took a toll on him as well. These men are just not, you know, they're not good, they're not bad. They're multidimensional. And so later on, after he had been purchasing these services for years and years and years, he wrote, "This is bad, very bad. I'm presently in a downward spiral in my life and may not be able to reverse it because of my behavior and the women I now surround myself with. I'm so bleep sick of my lifestyle, deluding myself that the garbage I boast about is a veritable substitute for intimacy. New country, new bleep, more money, but the same hollowness inside. God forbid the day I start hitting the minibar. I would give it all up in a heartbeat if I could." It became an addiction. Being able to purchase women for as cheaply as possible, being able to pay for them to do anything you want. And that's what happens. And so having this insight, I think, provide me with a nuanced perspective of, you know, who's fueling this demand? Who are the type of people that are committing these crimes? And it gave me some insight into the survivors and victims as well. One of the women that I talk about in the book, in one of the later chapters, I rescued her in front of Springfield Mall in Virginia. Her human trafficker was down here on a pretrial release for a malicious wounding charge against another woman, and he was selling this woman for sex. This woman had been trafficked on and off for 20 years, at one point being shot at point-blank range in the leg, requiring a vascular transfusion. But when she called the police arrested her for prostitution. They didn't arrest her trafficker. The trafficker eventually had his charges dropped. And this woman bounced from facility to facility to facility seeking services that were never provided. The gaps in service provision are so stark, it's not a surprise to me that most of these women find themselves re-victimized or criminalized post-rescue. She told me it took him 5 days to dig a hole so deep that it would take me 5 years to get out of, about her trafficker. And struggling to try to get out of that trafficked and exploited situation. It's one of those things where you're hearing about Operation Cross Country on the news saying we rescued all these women and children, but they don't tell you the story after that headline. They don't tell you the story that's in this book, that most of those charges are eventually dropped against the traffickers. They don't tell you the story that most of those victims find themselves re-victimized, criminalized post-rescue, denied services, with no place to live, no job, nothing to sustain and reestablish their life. It's harrowing. So also in the book, I wanted to go through the various forms of human trafficking. So I talked a lot in this talk about sex trafficking because I got a lot of insight from the different actors. But in addition to that, I talk about trafficking of runaway children, massage parlors, mail order brides, sex tourists, military sex tourism, gang trafficking, trafficking of legal non-immigrants. How many of you enjoy Chipotle every now and then, or McDonald's or Taco Bell? I think all of us have had it at one point or another. Do we ever question how we're able to procure that food for so cheap? Do we ever question where they get their agricultural products from? A lot of it comes from the exploitation of legal non-immigrants, temporary guest workers that have their documents held and are held in indentured servitude or slavery-type conditions, fighting, protesting. They'll protest for a one-penny increase per pound of tomatoes. We don't hear about that. We don't realize that. And I think sometimes we take it for granted. Domestic servants, door-to-door sales. I think we've all enjoyed chocolate at one point or another. Do we question where that chocolate comes from? 75% of our chocolate might be tied to the exploitation and slavery of children in the Ivory Coast. It's not something we discuss. Textiles, nail salons. Each of those industries is discussed in this book in depth, telling you how you are likely to encounter different forms of modern-day slavery. But I also talk about failed solutions. And there are a few stark gaps with how we are applying human trafficking laws. So I brought some items I haven't referred to yet for show and tell, right? Because I think it's important for you to understand the history behind anti-trafficking laws. Right? So one thing that I notice in how these laws are applied today was it's very racialized. Oh, incredibly racialized. I talk about in this book, during a one-week time period, I was interviewed by a number of media outlets for two different stories. One was a white mother who was shopping in IKEA, and she thought that traffickers were targeting her children. Do you guys ever, do you remember, have you heard of that story? So the IKEA mom that was targeted. Google it, you'll find it. And she was heralded as somebody who stopped her children from being exploited, white mom. And at first, everybody was saying, you know, great job, you recognize the red flags. But when I was interviewed, I said, well, that's not really typically how human trafficking happens. A human trafficker is not going to go to a public place and kidnap little kids with a bunch of cameras and people around. That's very rare. It would be an anomaly if it were true. But that same week, another story went viral, but for a different reason. The D.C. missing kids, the D.C. missing teens, those girls that went missing. They were, and the pictures portrayed of them were mugshots, right? Or pictures in unfavorable, you know, poses or, you know, not looking the way that that other mother did. And people said, oh, they're not being victimized. They ran away. They chose to leave. But when I was interviewed about that story, I said, those kids, they're the ones that are, like, at high risk of being trafficked. They're the ones that are at high risk of being exploited. And it was astonishing to me that people didn't take that topic or their potential victimization as seriously. And so I started to look back. And one of the earliest anti-human trafficking acts was called the Mann Act in 1910, right? And if you know the history of how that came to be, how it was applied, it was also applied very racially. So on the far right of me, your far left, I have an article from 1913, original. One of the first people that were prosecuted under the Mann Act for sex trafficking was a black boxer by the name of Jack Johnson. And his crime was giving material to his white wife to say interracial marriage was okay. That's what he was arrested and charged with. I also have up here, and I don't want to go too far from the mic. These are original mugshots. Bertillon cards of women who are arrested for sex work, for prostitution. And I'll pass these around so you guys can have one. Sorry, I like to be interrupted. I want you to look at those women. Do they look like sex workers? This is in the early 1900s. Or possibly could they have been recently emancipated slaves that were falling under Jim Crow and being exploited? The question, the answer to that question, I won't know. But I will know that during that same period of time when those women were being arrested is when we started to see white women portrayed as the victims of white slavery, sex trafficking. Now, while white women were being portrayed as being white slaves, being sex trafficked, black women were being arrested. And this carried on for years and years and years and years. This is a pulp magazine from the 1940s. It says, I was sold to Japanese white slavers. Do you have any guess when this might have come out? 1 year after Pearl Harbor, criminalizing who's the criminal, who's the victim, and portraying these people how we have portrayed them racially over time. So racialization has been an issue with the application of human trafficking laws. We also have a lot of efficacy issues, right? So next week, this upcoming week, the Commerce Committee of the Senate is going to vote on a piece of legislation called the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act. This piece of legislation is supposed to go after websites like Backpage that are being used to sell sex, right? They're being accused of facilitating the commercial sex trade. But as an expert witness, I don't think that should happen. I think that that website actually is the leading catalyst for rescues and arrests. And quite frankly, I don't think that they should be blamed for something that happens across the internet and has been modernized by the internet, and something that actually has been done for hundreds and hundreds of years. Perhaps the most rare piece that I have up here is this. This is a Blue Book guide. It is a brothel guide from the early 1900s of where you could find sex workers and brothels in New Orleans. These were distributed in New Orleans and San Antonio, Texas, but it didn't begin there. Before that, we saw these same type of brothel guides in England with Harris's List in the early 1700s. These have existed for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It's just evolved. It's evolved over time. So you have brothel guide lists. 1960s mail order bride catalog. And I hope you'll come up and take a look at these after the talk, because these are really interesting. It's showing how the commercial sex industry in our country has persevered over time and why pieces of legislation like this will not be effective. It will evolve again, and it'll be a continuous game of cat and mouse. Instead of passing legislation, and I talk a lot about this, a lot of politicians, they like to tout symbolic victories for public accolades, right? Look what I did. Look how great this is. Give me a pat on the back, elect me. As a modern-day anti-trafficking advocate and modern-day abolitionist, I think that we should be advocating for things that actually have measurable impacts, specifically the four Ps: preventing new crimes, prosecuting offenders, protecting victims, and establishing partnerships, like partnerships between these websites where sex is sold and law enforcement, so that they can facilitate rescues and arrests. And I think in doing that, in actually measuring the outcomes, we can actually make a difference on modern-day slavery, on the human trafficking epidemic that's going on in our country. And with that, I think I'll conclude my talk.
That's taller than I am. Thanks. Thank you very much. How's that?
There we go.
Thank you very much. As a lawyer also, this is an area that has interested me for some time. I have my tax master's as well. So I was going to ask whether there's been engagement around approaching this industry, this sector of commerce, not only from the, you know, I hear the societal issues, the social legislation policy, but taking the approach I'll use the example you cited of the pimp who was not arrested or prosecuted for the pimping charge, the violation of whatever that particular law in Maryland would have been, but rather for tax evasion and also violation of the labor law, so that there's a nest of laws created, and in some ways the early acts were labor related.
Mm-hmm.
So to draw on those network of laws, rather than, I mean, after all, that's what Capone went up on finally.
Sure.
I'm a big believer in tax enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just ask you what you're discovering out there. Is there a sort of conversation around the community of laws which can be effectively applied, not introducing necessarily new laws, but simply enforcing what we have?
Thank you so much for the question. I really appreciate that, and I think it's an excellent point. In the book, I talk a little bit about that because I do see that there are convictions for tangentially related offenses, so for things like money laundering or tax evasion. However, the cases that I follow, for example, one is of a massage parlor called Peach Therapy. Back in 2013, the owner of Peach Therapy, it was touted again by the Northern Virginia Human Trafficking Task Force. Look at what we did. We closed down this place. We prosecuted this woman. The woman, the owner, had been bringing in women from Korea to New York and from New York to this Annandale, Virginia suburb, and was accused of sex trafficking. Now, she was arrested for a tangentially, or eventually convicted of a tangentially related offense, but only sentenced to 3 years in prison and I think a $250,000 fine. Now, in the book, I talk about how Tom Jackman, the Washington Post reporter, went 3 months after her conviction, went back to that place in the same exact location, and he knocked on the door and a woman in hot pants and heavy makeup answered. To this day, actually, there is a massage parlor operating there with the same phone number, different name, of course, but same exact location, and they are posting advertisements on the Women for Men dating section of Backpage.com. Those advertisements have videos of scantily clad women dancing to sexualized music. And, it's plain as day. It's right there. But I think that a lot of these police officers have gotten jaded to making these arrests and trying to stick convictions, and eventually gets charge bargained down to something that carries a slap on the hand sentence. And so I talk about that case in the book, and that's frustrating for me as well, to see somebody who, this is being touted by politicians and police and task force members as a success story, but it's like playing a game of whack-a-mole. I hope that answers your question.
All right, I have three questions in rapid succession.
Okay.
What happened to the woman who showed up at your door?
Okay.
Why, and what's going on when some media outlets take the bends that they do with these stories? Why wouldn't they present it? I don't want to say that there's one objectivity here, but why wouldn't they present it in what you see as more fair?
Mm-hmm.
And or maybe I forgot the third one. Oh, yeah, what can we do? I can't untangle myself from a global supply chain that's partly economics, that when someone, offers a cheaper good,
sure,
it tends to move there.
Sure.
Or eating chocolate, but, I'm probably not going to stop.
Well, but there is free trade chocolate. There are chocolate manufacturers, smaller ones. Oh, yeah, go ahead. That do track their supply chain. The way that they market is bean-to-bar, right? Bean-to-bar chocolates. It is more expensive, though, and I talk about exactly how much more expensive it is in the book. So, that is something that can really inhibit people making change. But if you think about it this way, I think most people would prefer to put their money to, even if it's a little bit more, to slavery-free items. At least I would, and I would want to try to push that for corporate responsibility reasons. But to go back to your order of questions, so the first, what happened to the woman who was knocking at my door? So I talk about that a little in the book. I invited her into my house for dinner with my kids. We sat down, we had spaghetti dinner, and I read her from the human trafficking hotline website exactly why I thought she might have been in an exploitive situation. And she was really shocked because she said it really described her situation to a T. I called in service providers, law enforcement, to try to intervene, but she said she wanted to go back to the hotel and was afraid. I gave her my personal cell phone number. I told her if she needed a train ticket to go back to her family, I would take her there or take her to a service provider if she ever needed me. But once she got back into that situation with her with a person that was quote-unquote employing her, the nature of the text messages changed, and she started demanding money, and I just don't think it was her. I think it was she was back in an exploitive situation. And that's one of the things that is frustrating for service providers. A lot of these victims and persons being exploited, they don't realize it, and they're very recalcitrant or resistant to help. They don't want to be rescued initially, and all you can do and all I've done is always tell them that I will be there unconditionally when they are ready for help, and if they do need it, I'm always going to be there, and they can call me day or night anytime. And I've maintained that. The woman that I talk about in the back of the book that I rescued in front of Springfield Mall, I was shocked that after how many different task forces that I served on, that I was not able to get her a long-term residential placement facility. I was, beside myself. I've been, talking this talk for so long. I wanted to put her in a place where she would be safe. None of them provided vocational training. None of them provided job placement. It was only through a connection, a friend of mine, a neighbor, that we got a local beauty salon to provide her with a full scholarship to cosmetic school. And yes, and it was amazing, but it was only just through happenstance that we were able to do that. That should be the norm, not necessarily the exception. And I don't remember, the news. Okay, so I've had quite a few experiences with news agencies, and sometimes the clickbait story is the one that is most likely to get picked up. And I think that especially, I mean, it depends on who's pitching the story and who's taking the story. I've written extensively on this behind the scenes aspect, and I've had reporters tell me, why hasn't anybody else written about one of those things where kind of the story will die down? The arrests are made. They are arrested for human trafficking. But it's just that either the press release doesn't go out, that the charges were eventually dropped and there aren't any convictions. And I do know that there are other fact checker reporters that are looking for hard numbers about how many are dropped, but it's just very difficult to come by, and a lot of these agencies keep it close to the vest because, I mean, think about it, you're getting paid hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to be combating human trafficking, to expose the fact that your interventions aren't being effective. It's not, they don't see it as their best interest, and that's one of the things.
I'm going to shut it off right there, but I will say that this woman has the intellect and the heart to deal with this issue, and she has not only historically looked at this problem, but looks at what's going on right now today. I would highly recommend this book, and my gosh, the way she tries to help these people and yet can't do it with the current government system and rules and regulations and all kinds of things. But think of the lives of these people have been ruined and how their minds have been changed to think this is a great way to live your life, to be owned by someone else. So anyway, it is just an incredible book, and I would highly recommend it. And we're going to sign off tonight, and we're going to do it one more time, asking Vera Lynn to sing "We'll Meet Again." And remember, she sang to troops in the wars all over the world. A great woman.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.